Now would be a fine time to turn down the cell phones. It's actually a minute late to turn down the cell phones. There are new pages on the chair in the back. Okay. Bakasha. When dealing before the Chagim with the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot of the Rambam, and I printed out for you the listing of the positive and then the negative mitzvot that were Yom Tov related. So the first mitzvah that was really on the list there was Kiddush HaChodesh. Now Kiddush HaChodesh is not found in the scheme of Parshat Emol, Vayikra Kav Gimel. That's found in Parshat Bo. HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem Rosh Chodeshim. And next week in Mitzvah Shem, which is going to be Rosh Chodesh on Wednesday, you'll hear it announced this coming Shabbat, Tuesday, Wednesday, Rosh Chodesh. But Wednesday is technically the first day. It's Aleph V'Chodesh Cheshvan. So next Wednesday, in the spirit of the day, we will deal with that particular mitzvah where the Rambam has some very, very novel things to say about the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh relevant for our own days. That's in Kuf Nun Gimel. But today, we're going to deal with the other things in that listing that we didn't deal with. What did we deal with? We dealt with the Chagim. We dealt with Rosh Hashanah, a little bit about Yom Kippur, a little bit about Sukkot. Indeed, we didn't deal with Pesach because it wasn't the season. Mitzvah Shem will get to it in a half a year. I remember in Ramot in 1988, my first year in Ramot. So then I remember Simchat Torah, Shmini Atzeret came out on Thursday. So 2 days later was Shabbat Bereishit already. And I thought I was going to be a little funny. I opened up my drasha by saying, 6 months to Pesach. And two women fainted. I mean, we just got over Sukkot. And this man's talking about Pesach in 6 months. Like the word Pesach already introduces stress. It's like it's a gematria. Pesach a gematria stress. Right? Stress. Yeah. So, like, don't talk to me 6 months before Pesach about Pesach. So we'll deal with Pesach in its time. But the most important item in that listing that's not Chagim u'Moadim in nature, but nevertheless is in that listing, is Shabbat. And that's a little bit of an enigma of sorts, because Shabbat is very different than the regular scheduled Chagim and Moadim. All the other Chagim have something to do with an event in Jewish history, and or some agricultural event here in Eretz Yisrael. And I point that out, that whenever there's any agricultural oriented mitzvah, it has to do with the climatic conditions and the agricultural scenario of Eretz Yisrael. And if somebody happens to be a chusara, so you have to adapt to, you know, the halakha, to the local situation. But the norm is the situation here in Eretz Yisrael. It's true that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur neither reflect upon any particular event in history. Perhaps Yom Kippur, yes, because it has the first Yom Kippur was the chait of the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf sin, and the atonement for it. But Rosh Hashanah is not commemorating any particular historic event, nor is it agricultural in orientation. It happens to be a Rosh Chodesh. And as it is, it's not even Rosh Chodesh of the first month, it's Rosh Chodesh of the seventh month, because Rosh Chodesh of the first month is Nisan. HaChodesh Elachem, Rosh Chodeshim, Rishon Hu Lachem, L'Chodshei HaShanah. So Rosh Hashanah is somewhat unique. You know, we have a very interesting in a development in modern times. The Chofetz Chaim, who died in 1933, but he was deep into his 90s, and some say even 105. Well, we're not going to argue that now. In the 1920s, he was not a youngster. That's all agreed. He was not a youngster. In 1925, he commented, somebody asked him, he says, why after all these years from Briat HaOlam, now all of a sudden, mankind has developed the technology of reproducing both sound and picture of what was a minute ago, an hour ago. Because, you know, photography was in its infant stage, the turn of the century, the 20th century, and film was really in the infant stage. But the fact is that many of us have seen that clip video clip of the Chofetz Chaim 1923. So there were, you know, what they called moving pictures. That's why they were called movies, ultimately. Moving pictures, slide after slide, you know, in rapid motion. And that's how you have your movie, originally. And now it's all digital, of course. But Chofetz Chaim was asked that question. You can reproduce sound. You record the Yossel Rosenblatt. And he died in 1933 as well, of all things, and here in Eretz Israel. And today you can listen, you know, 90 years, 80 years later, to Yossel Rosenblatt. But he's not here, but you're hearing his sound. Chofetz Chaim responded that he said that up until the 19th century, before the age of reason and science, not only Jews, but the world, Christianity, Islam, the other religions, clearly believed in what we call in English the afterlife, or Olam Haba, of some sorts, however you define it. That means something is there, there's some type of day of reckoning, there's some type of Yom HaDin that will happen. And the way the Chazal, you know, describe it, that the Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to review one's lifetime, and you're going to have to sign on the dotted line, you know, right, this was me, I did this, I did that. And of course, you can always pull a Hillary Clinton 39 times, I don't remember, right? You can do that too. The fact is, in that stage of Nishama, apparently everybody will remember, and you had to believe that this was going to happen. But in the age of reason and science, so a lot of skepticism has entered into the thinking. You know, maybe all this is, you know, bubamaisis, supere safta, and it's not really true. So Chofetz Chaim said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught man, you know what, you can also do it. You can also do it. Because it was always thought that this was something uniquely divine, and now all of a sudden human beings have the capability of sitting here in the room and recording what's being said now, or if you had a video camera filming what's being said now and what's going on here in the room, and you can watch it in 100 years. It's blow by blow, every single movement. Whether it's a news event, whether it's a sports event, whatever it is, we know that. It's a family simcha, right? You show this bar mitzvah, this wedding, over and over again. But it's nice always to see the chuppah when you put it on reverse. You know, so it's watch them walk back if you have a long procession. It's always very nice. The grandchildren get a kick out of that. So Chofetz Chaim says this is really what it's all about. Because we have this technology, so all of a sudden you open up Rabbeinu Google and you discover that there are things on the internet now that you know, you have nostalgic feelings for a speaker who you heard. Just a month ago, the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, uploaded a shiur that the Rav gave in 1980, Tshuva Drasha. I had been in Israel three months. So I missed it. It was the first one that I didn't go to. And it was one of his last ones already. It was a short one, 2 hours and 20 minutes. Because the ones that we went to were 4 hours already, but the Rav was already sliding. But he gave the shiur, and it was a video, in Yiddish. And I just sat by the computer and just watched it for 2 hours and 20 minutes. I mean, you have no idea what kind of nostalgic feelings you get when you watch something like that. So just the other day, I didn't tell you what the circumstance was, but I caught wind of a lecture that was delivered in 1971 by the very distinguished rabbi of Beth El of Borough Park. Now, we went to Beth El of Borough Park to hear Moshe Kusevitzky daven, you know, for the Omid. Then he died in 1966. Then we went to hear Moshe Stern. We're upset that now they have Ian Miller for so many years. But the rabbi there for no fewer than 60 years. I mean, that's unbelievable. A rabbi to function on the pulpit 60 years. He was not a young man. Rabbi Dr. Israel Shor, Zichron Lebracha. He was an unbelievable speaker. And he actually thought that people came to shul to hear his drushes. And that was very frustrating for him, because he would give over sensational drushes, and people, you know, would just hear, no, finish up. You want to hear Moshe Kusevitzky, that's what we were here for. He would give weekday lectures, which I was too young when I was in Borough Park to even think about going, but there were people who went to, and they started video camming them back in the early 70s. So they uploaded some Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur speeches that he gave in the weeknights. They weren't terribly long. They were like 40 minutes, okay? But 40 minutes, you know, Rav Lichtenstein just got the engine started for 40 minutes. That's a 40-minute Rosh Hashanah Sikha. Yeah. And Rabbi Shua raised this point. I listened to it. I was just beautiful to listen to. And he said that the thing about Rosh Hashanah is neither commemorating a national event in Am Yisrael's history, nor is it connected to any agricultural season and so on. It is particularly unique. He put Yom Kippur into the basket too, even though Yom Kippur has a nature of history because it has to do with the Egel HaZahav. Okay, but not Rosh Hashanah. Not Rosh Hashanah. So that is unique. There's no question it's unique. It has to be analyzed and so on. But in the listing of the mitzvot, you have Shabbat. And Shabbat is not seasonal. The idea of dividing the concept of a week, 7 days, there's nothing natural about that. If you don't believe that division as found in the Torah, mm-hmm. then why should you come up with a division of seven? And believe me, in history, there were attempts to change it, to divide it into 10, that the 10th day should be something of importance. 10 seems to be a better number. We talk about the metric system. So the metric system is based on number 10 and 100 and so on. What's very weird was the British system, which then became the American system of inches and feet and yards. I mean, that makes no sense. But of course, the king's foot was so 12 inches long, so I have to call, you know, so that's how I have to measure, you know, a football field because of the king of England's foot. Who cares how long the king of England's foot was? But metric makes a lot more sense. I mean, even the weather, the temperature scale between Fahrenheit and centigrade, you know, Celsius. So 0 to 100 makes sense. 0 is the freezing point, 100 is the boiling point, and then you have everything in between. Beside that, what's 32? What's 212? It's famish, it's crazy. And then to think that at minus 40, they intersect. And if you really want to feel how that feels, both in Fahrenheit and centigrade at the same time, so when the plane is going high, it hits about 25,000 feet, open the window and stick your hand down. You'll feel it. Because then it's going to be minus 60, you know, Fahrenheit already. It's going to be too cold, so you put your finger out. But at minus 40, where Fahrenheit and centigrade intersect, the whole system is crazy. But that's the way it is. That's the way we measure. These are conventions. Just like the international date line is a convention. Because who said the zero longitude line is Greenwich, England? They made it up. Human beings made it up for convenience. So the opposite, the flip side of the zero is back in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And they thought that would be convenient because the day changes at the 180 degree line. Of course, no one took into consideration that Rabbi Yehuda Levi in the Kuzari gave some thought to this already and said that the international date line is Yerushalayim. And that was an idea that was developed later on, much later on, by Rav Gorin. Who asked me now about Rav Gorin? Somebody just asked me about, right, Faye asked me about Rav Gorin. So Rav Gorin, it was 1966, responded to a question about astronauts in space and how do they calculate time? Because time has to do with the rotation of celestial bodies and the revolution of the bodies around other bodies. That's how we measure time. But if you're up and out of space, the whole thing doesn't make sense anymore. If you're sitting on the moon or Mars, it doesn't make sense anymore. So the question is, how do you observe Shabbat? Because if it's every seventh sunset that you experience, which seems to be the halakha, by the way, and the proof is, if I take off from New York on a Thursday night, and I land Friday afternoon in Israel, when do I make Shabbat? 24 hours after yesterday's sundown? Or 17 hours after yesterday's sundown? I lost 7 hours in this trip. But of course I'll make it at sundown in Israel. So your Friday became 17 hours. So what? But it's the seventh sundown. So if your day is 90 minutes, because that's what happens when you orbit the Earth, it takes 90 minutes. So every 90 minutes you experience a sundown, which means every seventh orbit you have to keep Shabbos for 90 minutes. This is the thinking. You might have to observe Issa Melocha for 90 minutes, and then of course make a quick Avdolah, and before you, and then you have to quickly. This is all in fast forward now. Shacharis, tefillin, right? Shacharis. That's okay. That's how we daven any day. There's no difference. That's no difference. But then you take off your tefillin and it's already mincha. And you blink and it's ma'ariv. And then you already have to put your tefillin on because it's the next day, right? And then finally, after six orbits, you can take a breather and you take the tubes, you know, that the astronauts eat. The food is squeezed out of tubes like toothpaste, right? And you get chulent and you get kishke, right? So it sounds ridiculous, but Rav Gorin had to make some sense, and he was anticipating the day that there will be a Shema Shabbos or Shema Torah Mitzvot Asim. You have to give an answer. Halacha has to have an answer. So he said, obviously, that's not the response every 90 minutes. But he said, big chidush, a very novel idea, that you take planet Earth with you when you go to outer space. You take your food, you take your oxygen, you take with you your concept of time. And the only question then was, which clock do you take? Do you take the clock of the launch pad when you left, which for the United States would be the eastern seaboard, because that's where Cape Canaveral is. Once they called it Cape Kennedy, but it went back to Cape Canaveral. And or do you change your clock to Yerushalayim time? Because Yerushalayim time, according to Rabbi Yehuda Levi, is the universal clock. The universal clock. So there is such a view. Now this came up in the story of the Mir Yeshiva and families who fled to Shanghai in 1940 from Vilna, and of some, you know, they eventually made it to the States and so on. But there was a question at the time that they were in Japan, before they went to Shanghai. So there was a certain time they were in Japan. According to one shita, it was the question was which day was Yom Kippur. Which day was Yom Kippur, and had a lot to do with understanding the nature of the international deadline. And there were some people who fasted 48 hours, the Chumrah. They didn't demand that anybody should do, everybody had to do that, but there were those who went with this opinion, that opinion. So these are issues. These are real issues. But because it's just a convention, it's just an accepted human, you know, the countries got together and they said, fine, Greenwich is the zero line. So does that obligate from a halachic standpoint? Some Rabbanim said yes, some Rabbanim said no, some Rabbanim said maybe. I mean, like every other question, you're not going to get a unified opinion on this. But most Rabbanim look at the 180 as the Pacific Ocean as something that does enjoy halachic validity. So we talk about Shabbat. So Shabbat is something that's arbitrary. And it was divinely ordained in this coming parasha, Breishit, Vavaruch Elokim et Yom HaShviyi V'Kadesh Oto, Kivo Shabbat Mikol Melachto, Shebara Elokim La'asot. And the world accepted it. Not just the Christian world, which has accepted what they call the Old Testament, not only because of the Islam world was based on Christianity, except they forgot now that Yerushalayim was a factor in Christianity and in Judaism. They forgot all that. All right, that's not a problem. But that's where Shabbat. The truth is that in Christianity, when they were realized after the second generation that no longer are Jews interested in following suit, and they would really find more takers amongst the Gentile world, which ultimately would happen with Christianity, they wanted to move away from Shabbat. The original Shabbat of Christianity was our Shabbat. As simple as that. That's when they moved it to Sunday. They moved it to Sunday in order to deviate from our Shabbat. Just like Muhammad took several steps to deviate from Yahdut, where at the beginning he was they were doing things that were really carbon copy of Yahdut in an attempt to impact on Jews to join up to this religion called Islam. Like davening three times a day, like facing Yerushalayim in Tefillah, like fasting a day that would become their Yom Kippur. Then when Muhammad saw that they had no takers, so he wanted to become frummer than thou, so we're going to daven five times a day, and we're going to turn our backs to Yerushalayim. That's where Mecca became important. Mecca means you turn your back to Yerushalayim. Very interesting in light of modern day politics. And we're not going to fast for a day, we're going to fast for a month. Mitzidi, they should go the distance and fast a year. Why just a month? Ramadan, right? This is what happened. But the fact is, the week is still divided into seven. The week is divided into seven. A month is a natural phenomenon, and that has to do with the moon. But it's a lunar month, not a solar month. What you call September 1st to September 30th, that's not a natural thing. But we call Rosh Chodesh Elul until Kaftet Elul. That's a natural thing. But it's truly, it's 29 and a half days. We can't have a half a day. So 1 month is 29, 1 month is 30. So it adds up at the end of the year to 154 days divided by 12. Fine, that's how it works out. So it's either 29 or 30 days. No 31 days in the Hebrew calendar. But this is a natural event. It's the moon orbiting around the sun, Earth, once in 9 and a half days. And the sun orbits around the earth, orbits around the sun once in 365 and a quarter days. And the quarter isn't 100% 6 hours, a quarter of 24. It's a little bit less, but it's be'erich. It's be'erich. And that's why once in 4 years in the solar calendar, you add the February 29th, so it makes it up. It makes it up, and that's what they call a leap year. And so on. So this we know, that the month is a natural phenomenon, a year is a natural phenomenon, a week is not a natural phenomenon, it's divinely ordained. And it's accepted by the world. Accepted by the world. This is the division. In spite of attempts here and there to change it, not going to work. So this seems to be very different than any of the Chagim. So the question is, when the Torah begins the Parsha in Vayikra Kof Gimel, we call Parshat HaMoadot, the Parsha of the Chagim, Eile Moadei Hashem Mikra'ei Kodesh Asher Tikru'u Otam B'Moadam, and here's the list, you expect it to begin with Pesach, and then move on to Sfirat HaOmer and Shavuot, then it would move into Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur and Sukkot, and end Vaydabe Moshe Et Moadei Hashem El B'nei Yisrael, Adkan Vayikra Perek Kof Gimel. But no, it begins with Shabbat. What does Shabbat have to do with this? So everybody, all the Parshanim, jump in on this because it begs for explanation. It begs for explanation. So Rashi quotes a Medrash to come to teach you. The whoever keeps the Yomim Tovim, it's his equivalent of keeping Shabbat. The Shabbat, everybody knows, is super duper important. But maybe with Yom Tov, you can be a little bit lax because the halachot are somewhat lax. The penalty for violation of Malacha and Yom Tov are significantly less than on a Shabbat, and there's a permissibility of food preparation on Shabbat, Ochel Nefesh, and so on. So it's a lower order of Isur Malacha. So being that the Torah already downgrades the Isur Malacha for Yom Tov, so people have a tendency to downgrade even further. So the Torah says, no, it's like Shabbat. You know, it means take it seriously. Take it seriously. Rashi says that. And others say other things. But there's also a pshat. What's the pshat? The pshat, the simple pshat is that Shabbat belongs in this list. Most of the Parshanim attack this by saying, all right, it's really out of sync, it doesn't belong here, but let's try to figure out why the Torah stuck it in. That's Rashi's approach. But there's another approach that says, no, it's b'chlal not out of sync. Why isn't it out of sync? It seems to be out of sync. It doesn't belong here. We have to explain why it does belong here. So let's take a look at source number 1 and 2, which come from the Rambam Sefer Mitzvot Aseh. So number one, an interesting phenomenon. Normally when we say positive mitzvah, we mean you have to pick yourself up and do something. We call kum v'aseh, do something. Now sometimes the doing is not necessarily a physical act. It could be a mental, it could be a thought, an act, a thought process. Anokhi Hashem Elokecha, to know that God exists, you don't have to, you know, swing a bat. I mean, you have to think. You can sit, you can relax, and do some thinking about this. So that's also a positive mitzvah. But what's interesting is that there are some mitzvot that are classic don'ts. Don't do this, don't do that. And the Torah then comes and augments it by saying, and if you don't do this or that, that are prohibited, you have fulfilled a positive mitzvah. What's the positive mitzvah? So the positive mitzvah of Shabbat is Uvayom HaShvi'i Tishbot, and you shall rest on the seventh day. Resting on the seventh day is positive. You've created an atmosphere of rest, an atmosphere of Menucha. We call it Menucha Shabbat. An atmosphere of Menucha. How do you create an atmosphere of Menucha? By not doing A, B, C, D. That's the don'ts, the Lo Taaseh Kol Melacha. So if you look at source number 3, the don'ts, Sefer Mitzvot the Rambam, Mitzvot Lo Taaseh, Shin Kaf, 320, Vamitzvah HaShin Kaf, the 320th mitzvah, and there are 365 in the listing of the don'ts, Shehiziranu Me'asot Melacha B'Shabbat. The Torah forbids doing Melacha on Shabbat. This is what it says, Ayin Sin Hei Dalet Is Aseret HaDibrot, Lo Taaseh Kol Melacha. And that phrase is all over the Chumash. Every time it says Shabbat, Yom Shvi'i, Shabbat Hashem Lekecha, Lo Taaseh Kol Melacha. V'ha'over alav zeh, whoever violates this prohibition, ba'er bo hakatuv, the Torah itself says, karet. The karet, and that is im lo yada bo hadayan. That is, it never came to a court litigation. I'm going to go back to karet and explain this in a second. Im he'idu alav edim, if there were witnesses that he was mechalel Shabbat, and I'll just add, and there was warning, forewarning, before he did the malacha, somebody says, don't do it. Because if you do it, they're going to execute you in Beit Din. The guy says, I don't care. Afal pichein. And he does it anyway, and the witnesses saw it, and they brought him to Beit Din. Chayav skila. So he's executed by stoning. Now, let's not get too nervous about this. There's no Beit Din today. And even the days that there was a Beit Din, Rabbi Akiva taught us that the Beit Din did not rush to execute in any of the four modes of execution. Beit Din that kills once in 70 years is called the Beit Din Katlani. Once in 70 years, if it executes, it's a murderous Beit Din. What you see from there is that the idea of execution, Hotzah Lehoreg, it's in theory, but in practice, the Chazal, the Chachamim, were very, very wary of employing it on people. But all this is if it was mezid, it was deliberate, which the person really knows that it's a sur on Shabbat. But if a person either forgot that today is Shabbat, that can happen, by the way, you wake up in the morning on Shabbos, and you know, your mind's still not 100% clear, you thought it was Friday morning, you put the radio on. Right, you can do this. I mean, people do these things, right? Happens to human beings. That's called shogeg. That's called shogeg. Ask the person straight out, are you allowed to put the radio on Shabbat? No, chas v'shalom. But why'd you put it on Friday? On Shabbat, rather. Oh, yeah, I thought it was Friday. That's one. Or, the person knows it's Shabbat, but he didn't think that this particular activity was asur. You never heard of it. And that can happen also, out of ignorance. So, those are categories of shogeg. So, in the days of Beit HaMikdash, a person who violated avera of this nature, b'shogeg, he had to offer a korban chatat to Beit HaMikdash. What do you do today? There's no Beit HaMikdash. You have to cry your heart out on Yom Kippur. That's what you do. That's what Yom Kippur is all about. It takes the place of the korbanot. Now, karet, which appears not in every avera, there are only 36 examples in the Torah of karet. Karet means cut off. So what does that mean, cut off? So there are two phrases. One is hikaret tikaret. It's found in Parashat Shlach and Sefer Bamidbar, and it's explained in the Gemara Maseret Sanhedrin. Why is it a double expression? Hikaret tikaret. So Gemara says hikaret meolam hazeh tikaret meolam haba. So what is meolam hazeh? So this led many to assume it means untimely death. Untimely death. So what is that? What's untimely death? So the Gemara says 60 years old. 60 years old. You should know this. The Gemara has a precedent of one of the Chachamim of the Gemara that threw a birthday party at age 60 to show, not because he wanted, you know, balloons and birthday gifts and blow out up candles, because he wanted to express Hodayat HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he made it through age 60, and obviously, if he survived till 60, he most probably never did an Avera that carries with the penalty of Karet. And now he's on extra time. Well, extra time. The Vilna Gaon said that, you know, what is the amount of years that a person can say, we say in Hebrew, magili, I deserve. How many years does a person deserve, whatever that's supposed to mean? Vilna Gaon says 60. Every day after 60 is a chesed. A chesed. It says, Yemei shenotecha vahem shivim shana vim bigvurot shmonim, 70, 80, those are super chesedim already. And David HaMelech doesn't even talk about 90, nothing to talk about. It's quite a chesed. So at the age 60, every day over 60, you thank Kadosh Baruch Hu, you got up in the morning. No, I'm serious about this. This is what the Vilna Gaon said. Where does he derive it from? From the 40 years in the Midbar. Because the punishment began from those who were 20 years and up. And the punishment was that nobody's going to die prematurely, but everybody's going to get what they deserve. So the 59-year-old person died the next year. And the 58-year-old person died in 2 years. But in order to get the 20-year-old to live out to 60, they had to make a hakafas in the midbar, in the desert, for 40 years. And that's how the 40-year punishment came about. To allow the 20-year-olds to live out their basic term of life, which was 60. That's what the Vilna Gaon says. So the Gemara talks about making a party. You know, the great Hasidic Rebbes made big parties at age 60, when they turned 60. It's a very, very well-known thing. So it's almost an accepted norm. They were joking about what they're going to write in the Matzeva of Shimon Peres, that he gia terem eight, he is untimely death. Because people thought Peres is going to live forever. You know? Right. They say that's what you write in the Matzeva if somebody's 119-year-old. You know, 119, you're right, he died the terem eight, before his time. Okay. So this is what most of the poskim think. But the Rambam disagrees, as he many times disagrees with everybody. And the Rambam says that the focus of karet is not an age, a specific age of Olam Hazeh, but it means a person forfeits his right to Olam Haba. That's most probably, in a theological sense, much more serious. Much more serious. A person loses Olam Haba. Complete. That person's not interested in doing it. And what's remarkably interesting, if you study the, just take as the Dinat Yisrael as a case, because Chutz Laaretz, the statistics are so bad that it's hard even to make a case. But here you can make a case where I just heard just yesterday the chairman of the Jewish Agency, Gibor Yisrael, Natan Sharansky, spoke a little bit to an audience of Rabbanim about statistics of where the Jewish people, where they were, where they are, where they're going. So he wrote that 22% of Medinat Yisrael defined themselves today as Dati, Shomer Torah Mitzvot, in all different varieties, all different type of kippot. But he claims half, I think it's more than half, who claim that they're Misorati, but maybe he was talking about half beyond the 20%. That would make it about 70%, which is fair to say. A lot of the Sfaradim are downright traditional Jews, believing Jews, and so on. Then you have the remaining, you know, half are non-committed, and half of those are, you know, very anti. That's really what breaks down. But having said that, we know that 83% of the country do not eat chametz on Pesach. And 91% of the people in this country fast on Yom Kippur. And 96% of the babies born have a bona fide halachic brit milah. Why are these mitzvot making it amongst the general secular society? I mean, the fact that somebody who's the 22% makes a brit on his kid, you know, baruch, you know, it's clear. But why should somebody who's in the out of the 70%, why should be interested? Why? Well, what's motivating him? He doesn't believe in the tradition even. Who knows? Maybe he doesn't believe in God. So of course some say they do it because covered to the grandmother, you know, whatever, you know, that's true also. You know, sometimes they don't want detached completely. They may not even know why they're doing it. But the Torah says often enough in the context of karet, v'nichrita ha-nefesh ahi me'ameha. Karet means you've disassociated yourself from the nation. And that people don't want to do. And it's dafka those mitzvot that carry with it an onesh karet that you see much greater observance amongst people who do not define themselves as religious. They may not know that they're doing it because there's a karet attached to it. There's something in the psyche of the Jewish nation that says, this is serious business. This is serious. Don't trample on this. Eating chametz on Pesach is karet. Breaking the fast on Yom Kippur, I'm not talking about medical issues here, okay? Breaking the fast on Yom Kippur is karet. Not making a brit is karet. These are things that carry with karet. If a Jew is out of the pale of these mitzvot, who is he? Miyu Yehudi, that's a Jew. So that's v'nichrita nefesh ahi me'ameha. Now Shabbat is one of those cases where in the absence of a judicial authority to mete out capital punishment, so there's karet as well. And the truth of the matter is, I say again, lishmach, not lignai, here in Eretz Yisrael, it was ordained by law of the land that there would be a public observance of Shabbat. Now some people think, no, that's just public relations, it's just politics, political coalitions. Yes, it may be political coalitions, I'm not saying no, but that's just the mechanism of how to get the idea through. But the halakha does recognize a difference between chilul Shabbat privately and chilul Shabbat befarhesya. That's a halachic term. A mechalel Shabbat befarhesya is a person who we, to a certain degree, we won't drink his wine like a goy. It's a very serious stance. The Rav explained once in a shir because it's a negation of the testimony of God being the creator. So, you know, to do it so blatantly in public. So, mainly what a person does in his house, it's his or her business, as if to say. You don't have this with any other mitzvah. A person eats treif at the home, eats it outside. It's eating treif. There's no special connotation that he's eating treif publicly. But if a person unless it's in the context of in front of 10 people to make a whole exhibit, then there's an aspect of Chilul Hashem that's associated with it. But in terms of the core Avera, makes no difference if it's public or private. But by Shabbat, there is a difference between Chilul Shabbat b'tzin'ah, privately, and Chilul Shabbat b'farhesya. And here in Eretz Yisrael, at least there is an attempt on some level to have some type of Shmirat Shabbat b'farhesya. B'farhesya. I mean, this was dealt many times over with the Chevrat El Al. I don't know why you always think of it, but El Al, does not fly on Shabbat. If you think El Al is a company that keeps Shabbat, you're making a big mistake. Because if you apply for a job to be a talpanit, means somebody, one of the men or women who answer phones for ticketing and so on, they work on Shabbos. The only day El Al shuts down on is Yom Kippur. It's the only day. So what are they doing on Shabbat? First of all, you think the maintenance people aren't preparing the plane for the Motzei Shabbos flight? You think the flight comes in before Shabbat and everybody goes home to make Kiddush? And after Avdolah of Rabbeinu Tam, they first come running in and they have a flight to get off to Bangkok at 9:40 p.m., which, maybe in the winter you still have some time, but in summer you don't have a lot of time. They start putting a few band-aids on the plane to make it fly. You don't want to fly that flight, right? You don't want to fly on that plane. So they're maintaining the plane on Shabbat. They're doing that. They're doing a lot of things on Shabbat. There was a whole mitzvah with the food that the tamam that prepares the food. So they were moving it over. So they prepare in one place, then they move it over to a storage place where from there they load it onto the plane. And they were bringing it on Shabbat. And somebody cried foul, And they realized that the solution was that specific job was done by non-Jews. That was the solution. Because people who flew Motzei Shabbos flights and did not want to have a Chil Shabbos stain on the heksher of the food. They wanted it to be complete without, Shabbos. All right, a guy does it, not such a big problem. So that had to be worked out. Which means that Shabbat is a concern. President of the country, Prime Minister of the country, they will be very careful in public life, not to be mechalel Shabbat. I mean, I remember Menachem Begin of Shabbat, he was a Shomer Shabbos on a certain level, for sure. But he went to that time Sadat's Levaya in Cairo on Shabbat. He walked in the heat that time. He walked it's done. It's Yadua. They're not going to be mechalel Shabbos. Because Shabbat carry is serious. It identifies Am Yisrael. And having said that, that's why something that's karet has an upgraded awareness amongst Am Yisrael. So that's source number three. If we go back to source number one and two, so let's look at one. We have the positive side. HaMitzvah Kuf Nun Dalet Yishetzivanu Shenishbot B'Shabbat Shenevu Yomar Yitbarach. This is what it says in Parashat Mishpatim. Uvayom Shvi Tishbot. This mitzvah is given over many, many times. It says pamayim, but it means it's more than twice, because twice he meant mishpatim and kitisa. But so it's really technically twice in the Torah. Uve'er lanu yitbarach yitaleh aseret adibrot shashvita min amlacha yichova aleinu val behemtenu vavadenu. Not only are we to cease working on Shabbat, but you're not allowed to give the slave, an Eved Knan, he's not Jewish, but he's your property, can't have him do work for you on Shabbat, nor are you allowed to have your animals do work for you on Shabbat. This promoted a whole discussion in the world of Halacha. What about a Shabbos Goy? What about a Shabbos Goy? A Shabbos Goy is an institution, right? There was a great professor who was a member of Ol Nechama, one of the six Pras Yisrael laureates from my shul. So his name was Professor Yaakov Katz. His son davened in Ramot. I did know Professor Katz. He was Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's mentor at Hebrew University. Okay, so we're talking about a heavy-duty hitter here in terms of academics of Jewish history. His field was the study of halakha, the history of halakha, and minhag, and Kabbalah in the Middle Ages. So he wrote a book, a whole sefer, on the history and development of the Goy Shel Shabbat. What we call in Yiddish a Shabbos Goy, right? So I remember in the Gush, in the Yeshiva, you know, we refer to Svarim, we refer to great Gedolei Israel by the books that they wrote. The Mishnah Bura said, the Chazon Ish said, right? That's how we do it. So I remember they used to refer to something that Professor Katz said, and the Goy Shal Shabbos said. It was the Goy Shal Shabbos. They refer to him, they were talking about the Goy Shal Shabbos. The Goy Shal Shabbat. It was a phenomenal book. I have it at home. It's the history of the Shabbos Goy. It's how did it start? And believe me, it started because of need, because of necessity in shuls. It had to do with lighting. They had to get the lights on, they had to put the lights off, and we weren't talking about electricity then. And so there were very limited heterim that were given out to Kehilot to employ the use of a Shabbos Goy for specific needs, usually for lighting. But it was not a rampant heter. All right, you have to get something done, call a goy. I mean, so today, we sometimes have scenarios at home. The fuse box blew, right? And, all right, so if the fuse blew, nothing we can do, really. You can't fix it on Shabbat. But there could be an onik Shabbat problem, right? The food can spoil. There'll be a lot of things if it happens Friday night and so on. So Rabbanim are willing to be matter to use a Shabbos Goy. Do not ever look for an 11-year-old kid to do it. That's mamash asu. A lot of people think, oh, a kid can do it. He's not bar mitzvah yet. The Torah says, ata uvincha uvitecha. You and your son and your daughter are involved in Shabbat. So who's the son and the daughter? Not the 20-year-old son or 18-year-old daughter. The 20-year-old son is part of the word ata. Kadosh Baruch Hu speaks to you and to you and to you and to you and to you, to every halachic adult over bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. That's atah. So what's bincha ubitecha? Ketanim, under bar mitzvah. So it's true that if a katan, a 10-year-old, a 5-year-old, does something of a chilul Shabbos nature, nobody's going to hold them accountable, neither Kadosh Baruch Hu nor the Beit Din, and so on. That's for sure. But in terms of educating, in terms of having that child observe Shabbat, and be part of Shabbat, that's part of the Torah obligation. And certainly you can't use him to be Mechal Shabbos. I know people told me when we lived in the Borough Park, I used to see, so there's no Erev there now. They say there is an Erev in some place in the Borough Park. There's a whole Asik with the Erev in Flatbush. But in Borough Park, there's just 1,000 different Kehilot there, and nobody recognizes the next. So there'd be 1,000 Erevin, you'd get tangled in the web wherever you'd walk. There'd be too many Erevin going up there. But I remember there were certain families, and specifically, I'm not saying this chalil in any derogatory way, but from Hungary, usually they were platim, they were Holocaust survivors, and the kids would carry the talis to shul. I remember seeing it, and I would question this, and sometimes the parents would say, in Budapest we did this. So, all right, listen, I got my mouth shut, you know, Budapest. I don't know what the situation was in Budapest. They had an Erev, didn't have an Erev. I don't know. I just don't know. But, you know, I don't, with Holocaust survivors, I don't start up. You know, it's not right. So, especially in the mitzvah of tochacha, to admonish, the poskim say, if you don't have a fighting chance that they're going to listen to you, it's better not telling them in the first place, because mutav shu shogigim va'al yu mezidim. It's better to keep it on the shogig level, that the person thinks it's okay, than you go and tell him that it's wrong and he keeps doing it. That's a worse scenario. So, best stay, you know, that's all. But they would use kids for this purpose. It's not right. So you're not allowed to use a built-in slave. A built-in slave. That means that we don't have this today, but Eved Kena'ani. See, Eved Ivri we do have. It's called serving in the Israeli army. That's what I found out when I was in Tiranut. I figured out when I was in basic training in Tzal back in 1982, this is what Parshat Mishpatim is all about. You're Jewish, you're obligated in mitzvot, you can't do what you want. Somebody there is going to force you to do what they're telling you to do, and there are repercussions if you don't listen. That's an Eved Ivri. But all right, I did it gladly. But Eved Kenani is a piece of property. We don't have this today. But let's say an animal. But just an animal. If you have an automated car, you know that there are such things called automated cars? So are you allowed to have your automated car run on Shabbat to do work for you, deliveries for you? Are you allowed to do that? You know that there are things now called drones. We don't soon there's going to be a big issue. They're going to have flight lanes in the sky to regulate how you fly your drone. Now, one of the problems with drones is that it can be a real hazard for security. because you can they can drop a bomb. That's all very easy, you know, drop a explosive. But let's think positively. It could also deliver a package. So it's very, and hey, you don't have to pay a driver, right? You don't have to pay for gas for the truck, the upkeep for the truck. And just, you know, it's robotic. It's robotic. And you can, you know, train. You know, you can program this to work 24/7. And it can deliver on Shabbat. Are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to have this work on your part of your service and your business is you home deliver. And you home deliver it to the guy's backyard. Drops down nicely on Shabbat and so on. The guy picks it up after Shabbos, because right now it's Muksa. But are you allowed to do that? Is that called Shvitat Kelim? Shvitat Kelim means your tools also have to rest. So it's not that a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave Shabbat to the tools, or a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave Shabbat to the ox, or a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave Shabbat to the Eved. Kadosh Baruch Hu gave Shabbat to Am Yisrael. And part of the Avirah, the atmosphere of Shvitah, is that everything grinds to a halt. That's what it means. Everything grinds to a halt. The land is supposed to grind to a halt. So there's a real problem here. When you plant Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and things start taking in the ground, can you tell the ground from Leil Shabbat to Motzei Shabbat, all right, stop. You know, stop doing what it's doing. The ground's not going to listen to you. It's going to keep doing what it normally does naturally. So the Vilna Goyen said, make a cheshbon. How many Shabbatot are there during the year? There are 52 Shabbatot during the year. Multiply 52 times 6, you get to 312 Shabbatot in 6 years. How many biblical Chagim are there? There are 7 during the year. First day of Pesach, last day of Pesach, one day of Shavuot, one day Rosh Hashanah, one day Yom Kippur, first day of Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret. 7 biblical Chagim. And you're not allowed to plant in those days either, like Shabbat. Multiply that by 6 years of this, it's another 42 days. Add 42 to the 312, you get 154. 154 is exactly a lunar calendar year. So the Vilna Goyen says, this is what is meant by the mitzvah of Shemitah, v'shavta ha'aretz, Shabbat Lashem, and Rashi says, kimo Shabbat Bereshit, that we're actually are stopping to work the land for a full year to make up for the 6 years of Shabbat and Yom Tov that the ground didn't listen to us and kept working, as if to say. So how do you force the ground to come to a halt? By stopping to work for a year. The whole season goes by without agricultural activity, so the ground, in essence, is not working. That's what the Vilna Goyen said. It was a nice idea. But basically, the idea of Shabbat, given to Am Yisrael, is we should make sure that that things should come to a halt. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, who in many areas of halacha was quite lenient, even in areas of Dinei Shabbat, has a remarkable chumrah. Remarkable chumrah. So remarkable that in the Encyclopedia Talmudit, there's even an appendix on this whole issue of Shaon Shabbat, of Shabbos clocks. Now I remember when Rav Moshe Feinstein's one of my great teachers, Rav Moshe Tendler, Professor Moshe Tendler, taught us biology, Ki'ilu biology, you know, as they say, Yani biology. We were learning Aloha. We were learning whatever was on Moshe Feinstein's desk that day that had to do with science. So we learned about transplants. We learned how to take a green esrog and turn it yellow overnight, and how to transplant the Chazanish's Geklapta Arovis and make it into an Arova tree. That's what we were doing in the biology class, because it was bio for non-science majors. So he knew that he didn't have to follow the syllabus. These guys aren't going to be like me. They're not going to be going for medical school. They have to take the course. So he figured, you know, let's do something that's going to be interesting. We learned Hilchos Nida and then all kinds of things that there was a necessity of having some scientific background to it, and he was an expert, clearly. So I remember he quoted, he thought about Shon Shabbat. He said that when Shon Shabbat came out, everybody prohibited it because of Marit Ayin. Marit Ayin means, look, you know you're okay, you know it's a Shon Shabbat, but out there, nobody knows, never heard of it yet. It wasn't something that was known publicly. So I was taking a walk on Shabbos night, and at 10:30, I saw the lights go out in his apartment. He's really a Mechal Shabbos, and he wants Mafta Yoyne next year on Yom Kippur, you know, kind of business this. So he didn't know. So that's asur. That's forbidden. It's called marat ayin. You can't do something that gives the appearance of something that's asur. Even though from your point of view, between you and God, everything was fine. But Rav Tendler said, enough shkotzim got together and used it, so now it became permissible because everybody knows there's a thing called Shon Shabbat. Rav Moshe Feinstein comes along and says that the validity of Shon Shabbat is an extension of Shabbos Goy. It's an extension of Shabbos Goy. And because Shabbos Goy was initially validated only for illumination, for lighting, Rav Moshe said that you can only use a Shabbos clock for lights and not for any other appliance. It's a very big chumrah. So while in our home we may have on the air conditioner that nobody needs now, but it's on anyway. I wish I'd have a Shabbos clock now to flip it off. It's a little chilly here. Some people have it for the heating system. Some people have it for this system, for that system, right? They have to see Trump's ads on Friday night, so they have a Shabbos clock and for that, whatever. All kinds of things of a Shabbos clock. Shabbos clock on the dishwasher, Shabbos clock on that. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's all asur. One after the other. Now, I'm not saying I do this. And I would go further and say that Rav Moshe Feinstein's view did not become normative amongst Klal Yisrael. Fact is that everybody uses Shabbos clock today for multifaceted reasons of appliances. I mean, for use for TV and videos, the catch wasn't so much the Shabbos clock. It was that doesn't sit well with the spirit of Shabbat. That was a different issue. Plus, here in Israel, if we can assume that that Jews are involved in the transmission and the operation of the TV and radio, so you're deriving benefit from an act of Chilul Shabbat of somebody else, which you're not allowed to. So that these are other issues. What about in Chutz Laaretz? We can assume they're Goyim. You can assume they're Goyim, the wide world out there. And somebody, forget about Shabbos clock. Keep the TV on in a hotel room. You're in a hotel for Shabbat. You just keep the TV on and so on. So technically, from the Hilchot Shabbat, you did nothing wrong. You didn't put it on. You didn't turn it off. You didn't change the volume. Nothing. But is this what you're supposed to be doing on Shabbat? So that's always the question. What else am I doing? Reading the paper? You know, these are issues. These are issues. But with regard to the other poskim, they say yes, okay. Rav Shlomo Zalman allowed it, and others that you can use Shabbos clock for. But where does the Shabbos clock issue come? It's an extension of using a Shabbos goy. That's where it comes from. So so all this is in source number one, that we're supposed to create an atmosphere of Shabbat, of Menucha, and don't cut corners. Don't be what you call in Hebrew chokmologia. You know, smart aleck. And you're going to start using this and start using that, and basically it's business as usual, but you're okay. Don't do that. But, you know, life has its own challenges, and what do you do if you're a partner in a major business, and your partners are not Jewish, and we have this in Chutz Laaretz all the time, and the business runs on Shabbat, just you're a tzaddik, you know, you go to shul and everything. So Rav Moshe Feinstein deals with this, how to work out a contract that separates you from the business every single week. Because if you don't do that, then you're making money on Shabbat. You're running your business on Shabbat, essentially. And the question was, what about stocks? And obviously stocks, you're not running any business. You're just a silent partner, and nobody's really buying shares in Intel because they're going to learn how to make computers. They want to make money, you know, on the stock, that's all. That becomes a shaila with regard to companies that manufacture chametz. Mm-hmm. Do you have to sell your shares to the goy before Pesach because you're a stockholder and so on? If the goy would know how many shares of major corporations he bought for his 300 shekel that he gave the rabbi, he would check the paper first, because if the stock went up over Pesach, question is who gets the dividend? Not so simple, huh? I took the best way out. No stocks. It's a machna. Yeah.
During times of milchama.
Yeah.
What's allowed in terms of listening to?
That's emergency. Now, the question was the time of war here in Israel. That's an emergency situation. And then emergency halachot kick in. And when the Rabbanut said, yes, keep the radio on so that we should receive directives on whether we have to go into the sealed rooms or whatever, that's Pikuch Nefesh. I remember during the first Gulf War, so I would meet with the then Chief Rabbi, Rav Shapiro, and every Friday, I would sit with him and review things about the procedures. And I was interviewed on the Kol Yisrael in the English news to go every single for 6 weeks in a row. This is Rav Shapiro said A, B, C. I had it worked out nicely to give the directives that were palatable to the general audience. I mean, Rav Shapiro was a very difficult person to understand. He had marbles in his mouth. No, he was very difficult. I tried. Sometimes I asked. I once asked him to repeat himself three times, and he says, "Is yeshiva talamata? Where did you learn?" I said, "I learned in a good yeshiva. I just don't understand what he's saying." If I don't figure out what you're saying, you know, it'd be fine. But you know, with sealed rooms, with the plastic, with the radio, the Gala Shaked, it was the silent. The first week they said there's going to be a silent station. Of course, it was silent. Nobody can get tuned into it. So how did you get into it? So then the second week, the Gali Tzal said they'll run it a half hour before Shabbat simply by saying Zeh Gala Shaked. This is the Gala Shaked. Tune in, and then with Shabbat it went dead. You know, went off the. But it was on the air really. It was on the air for 24 hours, not broadcasting, unless there was a siren. And then it started to broadcast. So there were guidelines of how to do this. And God forbid, if there's a war, there are guidelines of how to... Right, that's emergency. Emergency, that's also halacha, emergency. Right? All right. We're not getting near the subject that I wanted to do today. But so we're going to do as follows. Next week, I still want to do that Rosh Chodesh shir because it's Rosh Chodesh. So I'm going to collect the papers, okay? And I'm going to hand this out in 2 weeks' time. Because we're going to get back to this. There's just too much material on this page to, yeah.
What are you asking for the astronaut?
Oh, so Rav Gorin. So Rav Gorin said to use the Shaon Eretz Yisrael. He preferred the Shaon Yerushalayim. That's what he recommended. But he said the local time, the eastern seaboard of the United States, would work for American astronaut. But this came up as a real question, by the way. Rav Gorin discussed this back in 1966. But it came up as a real question with the Israeli astronaut who unfortunately perished in the Columbia tragedy, Ilan Ramon, Allah shalom. He asked Rav Lau, I mean, was really everything was tragic about that. Among other things, he took with him a Sefer Torah that survived the Holocaust. And that Sefer Torah perished with him. I don't know if they found it. I know that the Israeli Air Force had a Sefer Torah written in his memory, and I actually held that Sefer once. I saw it twice, held it once, where I bumped into a delegation of Israeli Air Force cadets at Maidanek for a ceremony. Just last year, when I was there in May, it was in June. So there was such a ceremony, and they bring with them the Sefer Torah, and it says on it, in memory of you know, Chavirenu, you know, he was one of the pilots who bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor in Iraq back in 1981. But unfortunately, what happened? But he consulted Rav Lau, who was then chief rabbi, when he was up in the space station in the Columbia, with regard. He wanted to make Kiddush. It was Friday night, and he knew that the spaceship was going to hover over Medinat Yisrael at the time. So he asked Rav Lau exactly when to make the Kiddush. Now this was a man who was not religious. He was not religious, but was sensitive enough to know that he was there representing Medinat Yisrael and Am Yisrael, and he was going to do something of a Kiddush Hashem nature. And he did it. Rav Lau told him, based on the data that he was provided, you know, when exactly to make Kiddush. You know, and he made Kiddush in outer space and so on. It's very, very sad. I mean, sad that it happened to the other astronauts too. What are we kidding? But triply sad, you know, was, as I say, Michelano, one of us. It was very, very, very sad. So I'll tell you a better question that Rav Gorin dealt with. And that was, Mirz Hashem, when you visit the moon, because there'll be a lunar colony up there, how are you going to do Kiddush Levana? I cannot touch you while you're stepping on the moon, right? So Rav Gorin actually researched the various variant readings of the Nusach and showed that not all of the readings in the manuscripts had this line. So he said that today, because we are capable of stepping on the moon, so you cannot say Eini Yachol Lingobach. It's not true any longer. Of course, when you're standing on Earth, you can't touch it. True, but mankind has the ability today to come in physical contact with the moon. So that line is just out of sync. That's not the only thing that's problematic. if Ashkenazim would only pay a little attention to some of the slichot that we say in the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur season that have to do with Yerushalayim, that are so not true today in terms of the situation here in Yerushalayim, you'd just be amazed. Why are we continuing to say these things? They're just wrong. I mean, the Yerushalayim is not what's being described. It's not at all. Thank God. Thank God. But it's behind us already. And the only problem is we lack a little halakhic courage here to take a stand on the issue. And with Nachim, Rav Gordon did take a stand. Nachim is the tefillah for Mincha of Tisha B'Av, where, how can you say that the city is Bzuyan, Shomima, in Banan, nobody lives here. What do you mean nobody lives here? There's a million Jews who live here, right? So the Rav commented on this, and he said, all right, focus on Har HaBayit. So if you focus on Har HaBayit, it's still desolate, it's still without Am Yisrael functioning there. So you can still use the traditional nusach for Nachim and Tisha B'Av when you think of Har HaBayit. But beyond Har HaBayit, the whole thing doesn't make sense. The whole thing doesn't make sense anymore. Thank God that we're at the situation where it doesn't make sense. That's all. All right, so that's what we'll do. That's the game plan. We'll do Kiddush HaChodesh next week. We'll come back to this page in Mitzvah Shem in 2 weeks. What?